The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we were meeting last night and talking about today's show, as we often do. And you had just come from one of your radio interviews. You do a lot of radio and TV. And one of the things you had mentioned was you notice with some of these hosts, they can be very politically oriented and maybe not have any idea the importance of economics. And last night, the host asked you very innocently, you know, how does inflation really affect me? And it hit you that you really need to maybe give these people a basic fundamental understanding of why they're affected by economics.
Kevin, I guess the most basic answer to some of the economic concerns that people have, or frankly, the economic concerns they don't have but should because they don't see the importance of economics as a study.
Right.
Things like, can you take care of your family?
Right.
Will you achieve your financial goals? I mean, Kevin, I think in light of a 20 to 30% decline in the dollar, which we would anticipate over the next 2 to 3 years, and that would be, of course, after the present rally peters out, we think certainly the dollar has legs to 85, maybe 87 compared to the euro index. What you're essentially factoring in is an increase of 30 to 50% in consumer goods and services that you're used to having as a part of your daily life. As you experience the increase of costs, can you take care of your family? Will you meet your financial goals?
Well, and David, that's what I was thinking about after we met last night. I was laying in bed and I was thinking, how is it that we can restate this so that a person can understand, wait, the Greek default is important, and the fact that China is running a trade deficit for the first time. But I was thinking, how does it affect me? And the question came, can I take care of my family if everything cost a third more today? If I knew that all of my bills were going to go up by a third, can I take care of my family?
Well, and I think, Kevin, for most people, when they look at economics or they read about an economist's view of this or that, the reality is, it's very easy to understand how economics is boring because it doesn't appear to have any relevance to daily life, particularly the way economists talk about their stock and trade. The issue, Kevin, is this. They are dealing with very minute issues, intellectual details, which have to be parsed out to prove a point. And for most intellectuals, that's all they ever want to do is prove a point. The real issue within economics is how you live your life. If you have the means to live your life, what are the rules that impair the living of your life? I mean, these are actually things that do matter to people, but they don't necessarily see economics as relevant because economics are not written in a relevant format or relevant way.
Well, and I'll tell you, Dave, a great example of that is this Greek issue. We've heard about Greece for 2 years now. I mean, Greece, it's going to default. What's going to happen when it defaults? They don't really care whether Greece defaults because they don't understand what that means. But Greece sort of did default since the last time we've been talking, and it will matter because of the rule of law.
Well, and this is an interesting scenario. We have the Greek default last week. We have the credit default swaps, which have to be paid now because of a technical default, and it's going to cost about $3.2 billion.
Now, okay, but what's $3.2 billion in the scheme of trillions?
Yeah, because you're talking about credit default swaps north of $30 trillion. $3.2 billion is nothing. Now, granted,
right,
we're talking about a small country. There was more money on the table in terms of credit default swaps that has been canceled out, or policies that, if you want to think of it as an insurance policy, have been allowed to expire over the last several years as people figured, you know what, this is too political. It'll never go our way.
Right.
But you had the International Swaps and Derivatives Association get together, and they determined the payout. This is an industry group that has both an interest in the orderly market operations. This is the bond market, an orderly operation within the bond market.
Right.
Not interested in the Lehman-type moment where, yes, you're talking about $5 billion worth of counterparty risk. And in that case, it was not anticipated, and it caused a number of dominoes to fall. In this case, the ISDA and the whole bond community anticipated, there was no surprise, and they sort of led the investor through the process of getting their head handed to them versus it being a surprise event.
Well, the thing is, too, though, David, the people who own Greek debt right now, they took a 3/4 of the value. That was a haircut. They just basically gave it back, and they were actually willing to not call it a default. I don't know how that works, but then Greece came in and forced the few who didn't voluntarily do that to do that, and that's what started triggering the credit default swaps.
Right, because the ISDA looks at collective action clauses, which are basically forcing the hand of minority owners into an action that's not volitional, and that is considered a default.
That's
in their
a
opinion.
Gun to the head is what it is.
But
yeah.
The beauty is there was, to that degree, the perception of contract law being maintained, and as and when these credit default swaps are paid on, then you do have actually the maintenance of that contract law.
Well, the question is there resolution? I mean, has this been resolved, and are we finished with the other countries? What about Portugal? What about Spain?
Well, let's back up just a minute, because without the rule of law, and specifically without respect for contracts being binding, the capital markets as a whole take a major step back. In other words, the ability for Wall Street or any other center of capital in the world, whether that's Tokyo or London or what have you, Kevin, what happens is they don't have the ability to raise funds via bond offerings or stock offerings and things like that if there's not contracts backing what they are doing. Now, the part that is different than the implementation and the perception of contract law being maintained is that some pigs are more equal than others.
Well, what do you mean? Portugal, Italy, Spain, Greece.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going back to the Orwellian reference in Animal Farm. Mm. All pigs are equal, but some pigs are more equal. You know, and if you're the ECB, you're more equal. Because while there was a 70% haircut taken by the hoi polloi bond holder, guess what? If you were the ECB, you could take that Greek debt onto your balance sheet, and you didn't have to take a haircut at all.
Wow.
Isn't that special? So, Kevin, there is that suspicion that the rules will change in the middle of the game, and that there are preferential parties in the marketplace. They will always get a better deal, and that does ultimately erode confidence in the capital markets.
Well, and that's what I want to know. I mean, if I was a bondholder and I took a 70% plus haircut, I would probably not want to go back in and buy a bond like that again, especially if I didn't feel the contract had been held up.
Well, there is no resolution, and it's a matter of months, perhaps years at the outside, before we see the Greek government forced to renegotiate the terms again. Mm. We'll see here, Kevin, just in the next few days, how those bonds trade in the open market. They're already trading in the gray market at about a 17% to 19% yield. So what that implies is that, yes, it's just a question before we re-default. So, yes, first default, now we've got the re-default in the crosshairs, so to say. Kevin, the best way to avoid sort of a tortured recovery over the next 10 to 15 years within Greece would be, yes, to remain a part of the Eurozone, but drop out of the currency union and gain that ability to depreciate the remaining debts. So not an outright default, but default via inflation. The same kind of thing that we're doing here in the United States,
right,
just subtly and surreptitiously. They could do that to some degree in Greece. And yes, you could argue that that would hurt the banking sector moving back to the drachma, but it would give the entire economy the opportunity to regroup around their primary global offering, which is tourism.
Right.
They don't export a tremendous amount.
You want to go to Greece for cheap?
Yeah, well, if you become the cheapest, most beautiful destination in Europe, then people come in to spend their euros in exchange for your drachmas, and they get beautiful 3-4 week vacations on the beach.
Well, I'm going to swing to the other side of the world. Okay, Japan and China have been countries that we know have been importing to us far more than we import to them. What that does is that means that we run a budget deficit with them, but they actually have extra money to turn around and give back to us. Now, Japan is running a budget deficit. Now, granted, they had a tsunami, so I'm not taking that away, but Japan right now is importing more than it's exporting.
Well, and given they ran a budget deficit in 2011, and it's understandable given the crisis that they had with
right.
Fukushima.
Right.
So that's understandable. Now we're into January statistics, and they still have a trade deficit at around $5.4 billion. And according to the Japanese Ministry of Finance, this is actually the largest trade deficit on record. The real challenge is to imagine how Japan will finance this deficit. Up till now, yes, they've been running huge levels of debt compared to GDP, 200% debt to GDP, which is, you know, one of the higher in the world.
Right.
And that started 20 years ago at about 20% compared to GDP, debt to GDP. Kevin, these levels have, in fact, been maintained. And we look at debt as long-term non-sustainable. But here they have played this game and perpetuated the game. They've maintained it because they've been financing it domestically at very low rates. Now we have to envision the need for Japan to finance its trade deficits externally.
And like us, where we have to start selling our treasuries, but they're having to sell Japanese treasuries worldwide to try to just finance their own deficit.
And if it's financed externally, then credit may be viewed in a different light. So foreign source creditors versus domestic source creditors, this is a game changer, not only for Japan, but it's a game changer for the U.S. It really is the end of an era for the U.S. as we've moved from a creditor relationship to a competitor relationship in the capital markets. They need to raise capital to finance deficits. We need the same capital to fund our own deficits. You see how we're running into conflict with folks that we used to have a strong monetary relationship with.
Okay, now that's Japan. And again, this is a program talking about relevancy to the person who's listening, maybe here in America. We have worldwide listeners. We're not trying to be abstract here. All of these things do dramatically impact our bottom line. Let's look at China. China is a country that probably has been seen more as an engine of growth for America because we could buy cheap goods from them and they would turn around. And since we sent them more money than they sent us, they could turn that money around and reinvest in U.S. treasuries and finance our deficit. Now China's been shrinking. You talked about that last week. And they continue to try to bring about what they call the soft landing recession by lowering reserve requirements in the banks. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. And I think that old relationship is important to rehash because essentially China has offered us a subsidy, a consumption subsidy here in the United States.
Right.
Where every family, regardless of having declining incomes over the last 10 years or so, has been able to continue to buy the goods that they think are important, whether that's a new Apple product, whether that's a new this or that. The gizmos and gadgets that we hang on our walls, that we have, you know, in our car, and keep us entertained, these things, toys for our children, et cetera, these things were extraordinarily cheap because of labor arbitrage, if you want to put it in those terms,
right,
where essentially we're taking advantage of low-wage labor in China and the goods that can be produced via that low-wage labor. Now we're talking about an increase in labor wages in China. We're talking about a government that is trying to toggle back and forth between maintaining growth but also keeping there from being bubbles that develop. You know, they've lowered reserve requirements three times in China, and this is an attempt to manage a soft landing, and so far they've done a good job of it.
That's what we call easy money. That's where they start easing the money supply. Now that can lead to inflation too. That has to be managed.
But they're doing a pretty good job of that too. They've lowered the official inflation rate even further from 4.5% down to 3.2% in February. For context, that's off of a mid-year number of 6.5% last year. Of course, these are official inflation numbers.
Oh, sure.
Put that in parentheses. But again, the measures that they're taking have been very effective. The trouble for the U.S. is showing up in the Chinese trade data, just as we were talking about the Japanese trade data. And this is where you begin to wonder, maybe this isn't just Fukushima, maybe this isn't a trade deficit that's being run on the basis of a slowing economy, slowing exports, increased imports to rebuild the country or that part of Japan which needed it. Maybe this is a bigger story.
Okay, so China, and I'm going to go back to an interview that we did about a year and a half ago with Paul Craig Roberts, who worked for the Reagan administration, and he explained the simple relationship that we had with China, and it was very simple. We buy $450 billion more of their stuff than they buy of ours, which means they have dollars. They turn around, in turn, buy our U.S. treasuries, which allows us to run a government deficit of about $450 billion. Now, of course, it's much higher than that now. But that symbiotic relationship sort of was a circular relationship over and over and over, year after year. It allowed us to run a deficit. Right now, Dave, what you're saying is China themselves, they're running a deficit, no longer a surplus.
Right. Bloomberg reported that it was the biggest trade shortfall since 1989. China's current account surplus peaked at about 10% of GDP in 2007 to 2008.
So just 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, and it's declined to less than 4% last year. This year is likely to remain positive for the full year. This is the interesting thing. February's balance of trade registered a $31.5 billion deficit. And again, that's on the heels of the Japanese January trade deficit of roughly $5
billion. Right, so the Asian countries, the biggies, are running deficits at this point.
Which, again, these are trade deficits, meaning that they are importing more than they are exporting. But the problem is these are economies that thrive on exports.
Right.
They need to export products. they don't have internal organic growth. They must supply the world with stuff.
Well, and we need them to have more money so that they can turn it around our direction.
Yeah, because honestly, Kevin, if it was not for that subsidy from China over the last 10 years, we would have seen more of an inflationary bite, and it would have been much more painful, sort of the slow degradation of income levels in the United States. But again, that's been masked in large part because of cheap goods coming from the developing world, China specifically. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce, which expects to move in the direction of regular trade deficits over the next several years. The problem we noted with Japan is, again, apparently not isolated, and that's the issue for us. We will have to replace two of our primary creditors for real-time funding needs if this, in fact, continues.
Well, now, let me ask you a question, Dave. Okay, if the Chinese, for the last 10 years, weren't buying, say, $300, $450 billion worth of our treasury debt, if they're not there and they're not buying it, and the Japanese aren't doing it as well, who then does that? Are we talking about just pure monetization, or are we talking about the United States turning around and printing the money and buying it from themselves?
Let's use the word partial instead of pure in reference to monetization. Partial
okay.
monetization would be required in the U.S. market, but you would also see the need and the requirement for capital controls so that investors don't have the choice of taking capital elsewhere, and in fact, as sort of a captured asset, can be deployed, in essence, the domestic forcing of treasury purchases. We don't have any indication that that is being discussed or that will happen, but it is a logical outcome. It is a logical outcome from losing our creditors overseas.
Well, David, you had brought something up when we talked earlier about this, and it made sense. Okay, let's say that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury understood these numbers, these deficit numbers that we're just now seeing come across the pages of, say, The Economist magazine and Financial Times. Let's say that they knew these deficits were building last fall or last summer, and there wasn't going to be Asian buying of our treasuries. In fact, the Asians not only have slowed down their buying, they're actually divesting of some of the bonds that they already hold. But if they knew that, and Bernanke came out on TV and said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're not going to do QE3, but what we are going to do is we're going to take some of our money and we're going to go out and do an Operation Twist. Now, is Operation Twist a replacement for this Asian buying that no longer exists?
What it is a smoothing operation, and that's what the central banks around the world have tried to do over and over again with various monetization schemes, is smooth the pricing in markets where they didn't want volatility to be, mm-hmm. where they didn't want there to be quote-unquote price disclosure. If the price of something is dropping precipitously, you have to say to yourself, what's wrong with this picture? You know, if a stock goes from $10 to 10 cents, you can reasonably ask, what was wrong with this picture? That's the last thing the Fed and the Treasury want in relation to the financial markets. So, Kevin, just to back up a little bit, because we have not only a loss of individual countries that will be there to finance our deficits. On top of that, Kevin, we have, according to the most recent TIC flows, and we mentioned this last week, China being a liquidator of treasuries.
Right.
So this is very concerning. With China being a liquidator of treasuries, the cash flow for future purchases is also drying up. And again, we're talking about the cash flow from trade that we do with China. Again, that $450 billion you were talking about in reference to the conversation with Paul Craig Roberts, that is the cash flow that has been used for financing our deficits.
Well, let me ask you a question then, because one of the things that we've said is mandatory for China in the long run to become a superpower, they have to become internally consumption-oriented. And, you know, Stephen Roach, one of our guests that we've had in the past, pointed that out. He said they have to start buying from themselves rather than continually waiting for, you know, America to buy their toys and their products.
Well, so it's a very fair question to be asking. If the trade deficit numbers, the shortfall in China this most recent month, is an indication of a transition to internal consumption, or is it simply less cash flowing into exporting countries and fewer deliverable goods making their way out? Which is it?
Right.
Is it an export problem where we're not importing, they're not exporting, or is it they're beginning to transition to internal consumption? And is this actually a very positive element in the growth story for China? Kevin, global recessionary dynamics are in fact changing consumption patterns and changing capital flows to the countries that export basic stuff. And that's what we're seeing, is that what once was a surplus in these producing countries, and I'm talking about manufacturing production, is now becoming the surplus in places that are oil producing specifically.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Okay, so the trade deficit numbers in China don't have to be interpreted as Western European and U.S. decline-driven. I mean, it could be from other forms.
Yeah, because if consumption in China were on the rise, this would also explain a good deal of the trade statistics. But, you know, to counter this idea, we would look at the domestic consumption numbers and savings rates being a considerable variable. And in fact, we have a declining savings rate. So what we'd be looking for is a declining savings rate, which would indicate that China was indeed consuming more and saving less.
Yeah, but that's not the case. They're continuing to save more and more.
Exactly. So there's little support for it. In fact, we've seen the savings rate from 10 years ago go from 37.7% back in 2000 to now being about 52.6%. And it continues to rise. So the Chinese continue to save, but not spend. Consumption as a percentage of GDP, again, are we seeing a shift? And the argument would be no, because in fact we're seeing a decrease from mid-40s. Again, this is 40% of GDP consumption was several decades ago, to now it being less than 35%. It's moving in the wrong direction. It's moving in the wrong direction, which reinforces the idea that we have global economic slowdown in front of us, and what you actually have is the demand destruction for finished products both in Europe and the U.S., which is now flowing into China and Japan. They're exporting less. They're continuing to import just as much as they were, and the numbers are now turning into deficits.
Okay, David, I just want to play a game here. Let's experiment a little bit. China's now running a deficit. They've always run a surplus. We are running a deficit. Okay, we haven't run a surplus in a long, long time. Somebody's running a surplus. Okay. China can't be at deficit. We can't be at deficit without someone running a surplus. Is there a shift that's occurring that's maybe under the current that's not being talked about in the press where you've got somebody somewhere running a surplus where, you know, frankly, China used to?
And that is your oil producing countries. So you're seeing a reallocation of capital to the stuff that we wanted to consume, now to the stuff that we must consume just for necessary living.
It's a shift to commodities.
It is a shift to commodities.
Is this a forced bank war, like John Maynard Keynes talked about, where you've got a currency that's somewhat backed by commodity that's a worldwide currency?
Well, that's exactly right. We continue to run deficits various places in the world, and that's going to show up as a surplus in someone else's balance sheet. So that's a great observation. The money's going somewhere. If we're still running deficits, the surplus dollars are showing up somewhere. And lo and behold, it's the Middle East and your oil producers.
Well, and we've talked about the competition between paper markets and physical markets. Okay, paper markets are fine as long as everybody trusts each other, as long as the bonds pay when they're supposed to. You don't take a 70% haircut. As long as countries aren't abusing their ability to print. So, David, the big question is, will China continue to buy treasuries at an eager pace when the composition of their cash flows significantly changes?
Well, and we made the observation last night, Kevin, that nobody buys bonds just for fun. And in fact, that's not been the motivation by the Chinese. It's not even been a financial motivation. But it's to the degree that they can feed this dollar recycling that they will continue to buy treasuries.
Right.
However, and this is the big thing, if their cash flows are significantly changed, impaired, slowed down, if they simply go away, then they don't have the resource to allocate to treasuries in the first place.
Well, David, as the surplus started to fall in 2007 and 2008, you know, the Chinese came out and they had a strong investment initiative. Are they going to do the same thing this time?
Well, that was 2009 when that initiative was announced, Kevin, and it's run its course. Replacing the cash flow may be another temporary fix by a government cash infusion, which is what they did.
Close to, it's like $1 trillion, wasn't it?
Between credit put into the system and cash actually invested, $1 trillion. But the risk of bubble dynamics and food inflation is incredibly high. And this is where the People's Bank of China has to be very careful, because in China, food inflation is a little bit like a lit match in a hay barn.
I was talking to my wife the other day about this. You know, we were talking about China. Yes, it may be the second largest economy in the world, but as far as the populace, you've got like 7 or 8 times the amount of people in China that you do here in America. So if we had food inflation here, it'd be an issue. If they have food inflation there, the difference between the impoverished class and the elite class or the upper income class in China, there's a huge rift. And those people who are down on the lower end, They make up the majority, and they can barely afford their food.
Just to summarize, you know, declining trade deficits in Europe, and I know this is a little bit boring, but again, you go back to those questions of, can you take care of your family? Will you achieve your financial goals? The reason why economics matters, both domestic and internationally, is because these factors end up impairing the value of your assets and right. even your underlying currency. And so if you don't know what is doing this, I think it's very difficult to make wise decisions. You need to step out of the way of a coming disaster or get into the right kinds of investments that protect and preserve value during these periods of change.
Which is a resource, not a paper.
And again, we're talking about record deficits in Japan, record as in never been seen before,
right.
and you have to go back to 1989 for the Chinese trade deficit numbers. So again, these are unprecedented issues. The question is, do they continue from here or are they one-off events? If you see trade deficits declining in Europe and the U.S., then that means there's declining trade surpluses elsewhere. Okay, that's just take that as an axiom.
Right.
If you're seeing less money that's being spent, the overconsumption, so to say, and it goes away, those are less dollars flowing to those manufacturing countries all over the world. And again, this is just to summarize, declining trade deficits in Europe and the U.S., that equals declining trade surpluses elsewhere. So you're looking at U.S. and European consumption declining, which is driving those trade deficits down. Lower imports and a lowering of a trade deficit equals the lowering of trade surpluses with trade partners in Asia equals no ready cash for treasury purchases. We've got a problem because we continue to spend like drunken sailors, and we need someone to finance our current deficits, let alone our outstanding stock of debt.
Okay, David, so for the person who says, well, how does economics really affect me? What we're basically saying is the free lunch that we've experienced for the last couple of decades, there is no more free lunch. It's happening right now as we speak.
Exactly. The subsidy that we've experienced as a country is going away. The U.S. trade deficit, along with others in the world, not just the U.S., that it seems to be transitioning away from countries that produce manufactured goods to countries that supply basic commodities. And this is telling commentary, very important commentary on how resources today must, and I emphasize must, be allocated by developed countries. And it's also telling commentary on how everyday necessities are squeezing out the extras of life, the manufactured goods, which we don't have to have, the everyday necessities and the things that require oil as an input. That is becoming more important. Oil producers are the prime beneficiaries.
I'll tell you, David, it's fascinating to me. We're in an election year right now, and people are talking about some of the things that, let's say, the current administration has done wrong. Okay, that's what the Republicans are talking about. Okay, so, David, we had a relationship with the Chinese. We talked about that before. We had a relationship with Japan. Right now, that relation isn't quite as symbiotic as it was before. The problem is the people who we're seeing that transition to, we're also having to send carriers into their waters. I mean, this is a completely different relationship when you've got oil-producing countries as our next free lunch.
Kevin, we like to think of Iran as the primary concern in the Middle East, perhaps with Syria as a second port of call. Not that you necessarily want to visit, but that's where our Navy may end up. But let's ask this question, Kevin. If, in fact, oil producers are the prime beneficiaries of these trade surplus dollars, and we need those surplus dollars to be recycled into treasuries, isn't it a helpful encouragement to have a good part of our naval fleet floating around the Mediterranean, just as a friendly reminder that not only do we have enemies in the region, but we hope we can count on you as a friend?
It sounds to me like we're trying to juggle first two balls, then three, then four, then five. I mean, Operation Twist seems to have just been a delay. You know, when our treasury is having to go in and buy our own debt and change the maturities just to keep things from falling apart at the time. Now what we're having to do is militarily apply it. It reminds me, David, of the model that we've talked about over and over and over. The financial moves to the economic, moves to the political, and now we're starting to see the geopolitical and the strategic kick in.
You bet. Kevin, I think one of the things that we see as a major tailwind to the precious metals market is this lower rate environment where you have a decision made by the world's central bankers to employ what is called financial repression. Michael Pettis out of China, I would quote him just saying lower rates increase the financial repression tax on households. And essentially what you're doing in a low interest rate environment is reallocating capital from the saver, from the bond owner, to the debtor and ultimately to the banking system. And Kevin, this is one of the things that we see as a major reversal. Not only is there a credit quality issue within the U.S. Treasury market, where essentially we're insolvent and have no ability to pay our debts, and we're seeing our ability to finance them dwindle away. That's been the topic of discussion today. But Kevin, there's reason to believe that higher rates are around the corner. Financial repression of this sort was in play from 1945 to 1980. It's common, at least in U.S. financial history, but what did that period end with? It ended with a period of wild inflation and radically higher rates.
Well, David, I think when you use the word financial repression, I think of my grandma, and I think of people who they saved all of their life thinking that they could live just on the interest of their savings. You know, we saw that people could do that maybe a generation ago. But at this point, she told me that Greek debt right now is running at about 17 to 18%. I can call my 92-year-old grandma and say, hey, grandma, would you like 17 to 18% for the next 3 to 4 days before they fail? Or they can turn around and buy a U.S. Treasury and get, what, a couple of percent, 2, 3, maybe 4%.
But 3-month paper, 14 basis points.
Yeah, so they're not going to keep up. There's no real positive return.
Yeah, and this is the point. We often refer to Swedish economist Knut Wicksell. He predicted just such an outcome where lower rates ultimately lead to considerably higher rates. And this is what we contemplate. The bond bear, where is he lurking today? And when should our concerns become acute? We see a motive on the part of the central banks to suppress interest rates. They may do so for a long period of time. If they're successful, then we will see a tremendous bull market in precious metals that lasts not 3 to 5 years in a normal time frame, but 10 or 20 or 30 years on the basis of central bank policy, which is fighting tooth and tong, employing this new and subtle form of taxation called financial repression via low interest rates.
Right.
So this is the battle that an investor has. The battle for investment survival is no longer against the market. The battle for investment survival is against your central bank. As strange as that may sound, and I'm not trying to create conflict here, but you have to survive the next 2 or 20 years and this period of financial repression as creatively as you possibly can. That classically has been precious metals as an opt-out of the system. Too much risk, no reward, it's taken from me either via taxation or via interest rate suppression. I'm out.
Well, you know, just to repeat what we've talked about many, many times, to survive this financial repression, you can't necessarily have everything in the stock market, everything in cash, or really everything in gold, because you don't know when that's going to reverse. But the triangle we've talked about before, even just having a third in precious metals, a third in productive assets, so over on the left side of the triangle in stocks and bonds, and then a third in cash, that may not be perfect, but it does cover the bases, doesn't it?
Kevin, this is one of the most epic battles that I think investors will ever get to see. And again, it's financial and it's economic, and as far as most people's daily lives, it may not have any bearing whatsoever. But when you go to finance a house and it costs you 16, 18% as a mortgage rate instead of 3.85%, I'm telling you these things do matter. They do matter, and you do need to be asking the question, can I take care of my family? Will I achieve my financial goals? As this battle unfolds between interest rate suppression on the one hand and the market dynamics, which would naturally draw interest rates considerably higher.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.